Hello, this is Matt Hale with Art Monthly's show on Resonance Radio's 104.4 FM. And I'm joined today by the editor of Art Monthly magazine, Patricia Bickers, and Alex Coles, who's written for us many times and has written a feature in the last issue. This is basically a show based around the new issue, and we're going to just link three features together. Well, one's an interview, and there are two features, one of which was written by Alex. Now, our writer, Anna Deserz, is not around. I'm afraid she's in America, in New York, which we're very pleased to say, but we're regretful she's not in the studio, of course. But Patricia will, I'm quite sure, eloquently talk about what she's written. And also we have an interview, as I said, which is by Colleen Milliard with Sturtevant, or Sturtevant, I'm not quite sure how you say it. And Alex has written also about design art. Now, there is a kind of thread, I think, across these three features, and the idea of the programme is to try and draw those out, but keep it in mind. And it seems to be one word, really, which is appropriation. And it's different forms of appropriation. Now, there are obviously other things which are in the features, particularly perhaps in Alex's one. And we're going to start from the beginning of the magazine, beginning with the Sturtevant interview. Now, Patricia, can you just give us an outline, basically even in what way, for instance, Sturtevant's work relates to appropriation and what appropriation is?
Well, it's interesting that most people assume that Sturtevant is the ultimate appropriation artist, and it's one of the things that annoys her considerably, because in fact she was born, I'm sure she won't mind my saying, in 1930, and the first time she appropriated, in inverted commas, a work by another artist was Frank Stella, when Stella was actually making his signature works. So while he was showing, so was she, apparent replicas or simulacra,
really,
of Warhol's work and Jasper John's. And so this was not subsequent, as was done in the 80s by Louise Lawler, another generation, much younger.
Who were called appropriationists.
Who were called appropriationists. And she denies this because she says actually her business is repetition. And fascinatingly, for her, it's about the transition from image to concept. What happens when you repeat something and you remove it from its original context? I mean, that's a Duchampian gesture, perhaps. But then a whole different discourse surrounds this apparently identical object.
A different discourse or image. To the original.
Yes, and even if it is an object, she says, by copying it, you create an image of it, because it's a representation of the other object, the originating object. And so that was her debate. But she says, to this day, people still think it's merely about copying.
Right, which is very interestingly wrong. I mean, it's quite understandable.
It's
wrong.
Subtle, yes. Very subtle.
Yeah. Do you want to say slightly more about what the appropriationists thought? They, I mean, if she's not an appropriationist, can you just help me with a little more explanation of what the appropriationists thought they were, and why they were called that?
In difference to
copying, I mean.
Well, I'm not sure I can answer that question. I've outlined what Sturtevant's position is. I'm not sure I absolutely can see a difference.
No, okay.
I'm sure, one of the things is that the second generation, 20 years later, Louise Lawler and Mike Bidlow, Jeff Koons even, Sherry Levine, whom she admires greatly, they all made their appropriations in the light of her originating repetition work.
Yes, yes.
So you could say that's one difference, that it's a third remove, you might say.
Yes.
But also they were much more involved in institutional critique, in what happened when you repeated something and altered the context. She was much more concerned with the power of art and what happens when you re-present it and when it becomes merely an image, particularly retrospectively, because now she's very concerned about what she calls the cyber world and how we are all now reduced to images and what has happened to our power and the power of art in the cyber world.
Yes, yes. Well, if we then went to move to the next feature, which would be another form of appropriation, obviously dealing with images. It's called in the magazine Ad Men by Anna Desures. I mean, it seems to be to me about artists who make work which is then appropriated by large advertising agencies and the corporations that are employing them. I mean, that's a different kind of appropriation, do we think? Alex, do you want to just say, do you think it's different to... Well, I mean, tell me if it isn't different, because it's quite okay.
I think what's interesting, what Anna Desures picks up in her feature on the appropriation of art by advertising, is that she, there starts to become a legal discourse that's...
Copyright, perhaps.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what strikes me is that, I mean, something that she does quite well bring up in the feature is that already many of the artist's ideas that are appropriated or stolen by advertising companies are already appropriations in their own right.
Can you say how?
Well, for instance, with the Simon Faithfull piece, I think Desures suggests that already some of the ideas he uses are taken from cinema, sort of avant-garde cinema of the 50s and 60s.
Yes.
So for Faithfull to then, bolt and sort of say, you know, put his hand up and say unfair play when he in turn's appropriated by big business.
Yes.
Seems to me to be sort of playing the outsider artist a little bit. And I also think that these guys must be really naive to have discussions with brands like Toshiba and Apple with the kind of mechanisms they have in place and not take a lawyer with them to one of the brainstorming sessions or whatever it is that the artists were brought in on.
Well, yes, to reiterate some of the famous examples here, obviously Gillian Waring and Volkswagen, where they appropriated her signs that say what you want them to say and not what other people want them to say. And Volkswagen took this over, and of course, as Anna Desures points out, people think of it as a complete appropriation, but in fact they actually turned the work on its head because they actually told people what to say with their cards. So
it was the opposite.
It's the absolute opposite. But of course, visually it looked the same. And Anna Desures' point here, that there's two points she makes, I think. The other famous example being Fishley Vice, which was adapted by Honda for Cog, which was their Del After Dinger, the way things are, which is a kind of a chain reaction.
Yes.
And Anna Desures, I think, is making two points. One, that it's easier to appropriate the work of conceptual artists, and that, in fact, copyright law doesn't really protect ideas, only the expression of ideas. So that makes conceptual artists apparently vulnerable to being appropriated by advertisers. The second point is a power issue, and that's maybe something we can come back to, disproportionate power between corporations, advertisers and their clients, and on the one hand, artists.
Because she mentions about the copyright law, the expression and idea.
That's right.
But somehow or another, in Gillian's work, there was a coming together of expression and idea, so the law didn't help Gillian.
Well,
I don't fully understand that. We have a wonderful writer, Henry Lydiot, who may come on the programme in the future to help explain some of the issues that come up over a number of articles about law.
Well, the law is a blunt instrument, and that is always the problem. But as Alex quite properly says, you know, to arrive without a lawyer, if you are going to sup with the devil, you should take a long spoon. If you have some clout, as Fishley Vice do, then you can tackle the advertisers and get an out-of-court settlement.
Right.
But Gillian Waring considered it, but just at the same time, a young filmmaker had been ripped off, if that's what we're really talking about here, by Saatchi, who owned 10-8, an edition of 10-8.
Richard Wilson.
No.
No, sorry.
Sorry, 10-8, Gillian Waring.
Oh, sorry.
10-8. And so he owned an edition of that work. He appropriated it for a Guinness for an ad, and she couldn't even take him on board because of this example of this young filmmaker who had made a Guinness ad, and Saatchi was again involved. And he did sue and ended up having to pay £200,000 in costs.
Gulp.
And Gillian was aware of this, and as a precedent, she couldn't risk having to pay out. So that's the inequality issue.
Mm. It does reveal the complication, though, as well, that Saatchi being someone who buys art and then...
And then thinks he owns it and owns its copyright.
Yeah, it's very complicated. Just quickly going back to Sturtevant, when she remade and presented Stella's work, was there any problem with him, or did he know? Do you know?
Well, one part that was taken out of the interview by Sturtevant, and that's her right, was a reference to the fact that commercial dealers were panic-stricken when she began to do this work because, of course, of the whole issue of value, market value.
Yeah.
But the artists, most of them, and Stella in particular, whom she knew, was fairly easygoing about it.
Sort of flattery in a way.
Yes, but also they were both, as I say, contemporaries working at the same time.
Yes.
So it's the kind of thing artists do amongst themselves.
Yes.
It's only with the passing of time that this gesture starts to take on different connotations, mostly to do with market value and ownership and copyright.
I know little about her. I mean, and it sounds like you certainly know more than me. So maybe, I mean, what interests me is that, you know, by the 80s with the pictures generation and their, you know, the sort of the way they were legitimated through the debates around institutional critique, their place was very secure, certainly by the sort of early mid-80s, whereas it strikes me she must have been in quite an odd place in the 60s.
Definitely. In fact, she lives in Paris, which I think possibly tells its own story. She said that the 60s became very difficult for her, and that although she's not an appropriationist and rejects that designation, she's grateful for the appearance of the appropriationist because it gave a context for her work, and she said suddenly people began to understand it.
Mm.
But as Colleen points out, her reputation was really made in Europe.
So did she, just because I'm confused, did she know Frank Stella then?
Yes.
Okay. Who's an American painter, just for those who might not know. I'm catching up as we go along, guys. okay. So let's go to the third feature, perhaps, and see if we can bring that in as well. Because, Alex Coles, you've written what we've called design art as a feature. And crudely speaking, there is appropriation within your article. I mean, it's mentioned. It's not only what it's about, I understand. But could you tell us how you think the appropriation is occurring with the work that is referred to as design art? Is it a fair word to apply, do you think?
I mean, I think, you know, it's a very... It's what we were talking about with the 80s and the 60s are artists that are categorised within appropriation as a sort of theoretical, critical category. Whereas this notion of design art, may it rest in peace, is a... has not been accorded that kind of legitimacy in terms of the notion of appropriation. It's not thought of in that way.
No.
But indeed, you could suggest that what has happened with design art is that designers have appropriated certain forms and concepts from artists, and they've been retailed, as it were, through design galleries. And what we've seen then is the birth of this kind of notion of design art as a phenomena, as we get Design Miami in 2005.
That's an art fair.
as a design fair.
Yes. Sorry, not an art fair, I got that wrong.
As a design fair that privileges design art. We had the Design Art Fair for 2 years that took place in Berkeley Square at the same, roughly the same dates as Frieze. Some of the biggest, you know, museums and commercial galleries have you know, sort of bought in one way or another into the theme. So I think that there's a notion of appropriation going on, but it's very, very different. It's
okay.
Very different.
Yes. I mean, sorry, Patricia.
Well, I'm just wondering that, you know, to play devil's advocate here, that you write quite properly say that the art world persists in perceiving design as inferior to art. And you say appropriating or working with concepts of art. I think possibly what artists often complain of is that design art actually appropriates the look of art rather than actually engaging with the concepts that underlie objects that appear similar. And that, of course, is the whole key to appropriation, when works look identical but actually are theoretically underpinned by quite different preoccupations.
Yeah, which it is. I mean, whether what the preoccupation is, presumably, is function or sale, at least, in the design art world.
There tends to be this sort of playoff between what's traditionally or conservatively associated with design, which is utilitarian function in some way, and what is traditionally conservatively associated with art, which is aesthetic function. But as we know from the, you know, historical avant-garde onwards, those categories have been mixed up and are far more sort of imbricated in one another. So there's not two separate histories. Design and art do not have two separate distinct histories. They overlap at many points in the teens, in the 20s, in the 60s, in the 80s. So what I'm interested in is a sort of more, the possibility of a more fruitful debate between designers and artists, which doesn't just rely on the appropriation of the look of design or whatever. That's a sort of much more thorough conceptual interrogation of the relationship between design and art.
In the feature, the main illustration on the first page is of a work by Richard Woods and Sebastian Rong. I think I got that right. I thought I said, but which is possibly an example of a sideboard cabinet, I think, with drawers, but it's got a look on it, which is identifiable clearly to me as by Richard Woods, and the object I believe to be clearly by Sebastian Rong, which is a sort of a collaboration, but it's very kind of one is applied to the other, and I don't know how that fits with, but that's what I would know. I don't want to put words into anyone's mouth. What do you feel about that particular work as an example of? I mean, is that a good example of design art's worst features, or is it?
I guess. I mean, no, I know what you're trying to get me to say. I think that it's. I just don't find it that interesting because it's. You know, Richard Woods is an artist that perhaps is interesting at some points when this language he's developed, i.e., this kind of faux wood paneling.
Yeah.
Is used in contexts where it's not expected, such as to cover a gallery.
Was that the one in Milton Keynes?
In Chelsea or Milton Keynes. Whereas when that look is applied to a design object, I think it's just the result's less interesting, although infinitely more better value, I suppose, because it's probably cheaper than one of his artworks, and you can actually put your clothes or your,
yes,
you know, CDs.
You get art and function together.
So, I mean, what's interesting about design art is even the most expensive design art is much cheaper than the most expensive art. So, although a lot's been made from the way galleries and museums have come together, for instance, this is Richard Woods and his gallery coming together with Established & Sons, which is one of the most powerful. Would be like the Gagosian or something, I suppose, of the commercial design gallery world. It's quite a strategic, clever coming together of these two, you know, of these two sort of creative minds, I suppose, but also interested financial parties.
Yeah.
But you think that's where actually the appropriation is occurring, where they're actually appropriating the manner of presenting art in galleries to design and design art, and of course this gives it the same cachet and raises its value, if not aesthetic, certainly commercial value.
They're using galleries. I mean, Ron Arad is at Timothy Taylor Gallery,
Barbican.
Exactly. So one show will be art, and the next will be thought of as art because of the visitor going to the same venue.
Sure.
And all that, you think, well, if they think that's art, they must think this is art.
I mean, these galleries, the commercial design galleries, have been very canny because they've moved, like Established & Sons has just moved to near, you know, why Cube is
in London, near the square,
in St. James's,
Mason's Yard.
And so, people, just by geographical association, people will, you know, so say they have an opening the same night as two or three of the art galleries in their area. The sort of line, I suppose, especially after a few cheap bowls of beer,
it's the same audience.
The line starts to become blurred between these different worlds. When in fact, it's quite distinct.
But do you think linking all these, and possibly even with the content of the editorial, is this disproportionality that we were talking about earlier that Anna Deserves speaks about? You were saying that, you know, to buy a sideboard by Richard Woods is cheaper than buying an artwork by him. But the people making the money are the manufacturers. Hmm. The people making the money out of appropriating art are the advertisers and their clients, the corporations. Hmm. Similarly, the issue in the editorial is about how art constantly sells itself cheap. If you are going to go down this road of courting big business, of marketing yourself, then I just notice in today's Times, which I read in the cafe, I don't buy the Times, is what I'm saying, and there's a four-page ad with Rothschild Private Bank. Two-thirds of it is taken up by an image of Christo that they own to show that they're innovative and cutting edge. Mm. How much of that does Christo see? And similarly, Tate rolls over for a corporation like BP. Mm. For what? They constantly sell themselves cheap. Art is good business.
Yes, yes, and it's being abused. On a slightly more optimistic note, in your article towards the end, you, Alex, you do mention Eliasson. I will not say it right, however much I try. But as a kind of positive version of where, well, I don't want to describe him. I'd rather you told me about him because it is a more positive note in a way, as far as I can tell from your piece.
Yeah, I mean, he's in a way, I think my two features stuck together.
Sure.
To be truthful, it's not that well composed, really, because I think it goes through, you know, this design art phenomenon and says how this has really taken us nowhere. This interdisciplinary notion of design art. Interdisciplinary, I mean, you know, the coming together of design and art. And what I felt one path for the future was where this notion of a transdisciplinary practice, whereby there are no boundaries between disciplines, or no boundaries between disciplines. And I think Eliasson and Jorge Pardo and that generation of artists have negotiated that boundary best in recent history. You know, Eliasson is someone whose work I took no note of when I saw, you know, the large, enormous piece at the Tate.
The Weather?
Yeah, the Weather Project piece. And
was that The Big Sun?
That's right, The Big Sun, that everybody sort of, you know, enjoyed. And I took very little notice of his work until I went to his studio, and which I kind of briefly recorded in the article.
Yes, yes.
And there was something about the way the studio operated and the kind of studio as a think tank. I don't just mean in a loose sense of the word. I mean in a real sense of the word.
The way it was structured as a building.
The way it was structured. And in fact, this is something that my next book's going to be about, the notion of the transdisciplinary studio.
We look forward to it.
Thank you. It'll be $12.99 in all the bookshops.
When do you get a publisher? Have you got one?
Oh, I have. Yes,
great,
yes.
Great.
Thank you. And so what I wanted to do, rather than just for the article to be a sort of finishing off of a chapter, i.e. of design art, I wanted, you know, a sense of looking forwards, to end on a note of optimism.
Yes.
Where I think this debate can go, and I think this notion of transdisciplinary practice.
Can you just flesh that out a little more? What I mean, for instance, how was the building structure? Because you do say, I mean, it's quite all right to say.
I mean, as I remember, I think on the top floor there was an MFA program that was run.
So he actually had a kind of teaching.
Yeah,
section.
Yeah, sort of unit up there.
And that, you mean by MFA, mean Master of Fine
Exactly.
Art? Fine art, though.
Yeah, fine art.
It is
yeah.
a little Bauhaus-like.
It is.
Well, it does sound like it.
It's in an old brewery. I mean, many obviously many people are interested in his work and have got more knowledge of it than
I. No, sure, I'm not asking you to be a coming expert, but I just, but this idea of transdisciplinary, well, I think it is very interesting, but we haven't really said what we mean.
No, and it struck me that on the top floor there was this MFA program. Say on the next floor there were studios where graphic designers, product designers, and architects worked. On the next floor down, there was a large space where the projects were actually tried out, almost full scale. Yes. So, I mean, very.
It sounds a little bit like an architect's office.
It resembles an architect's office in look, maybe, but its tone is very different because it's much more reflexive. It's much. I mean, for instance, there will be a project with BMW that's taking place at the same time as a large, retrospective in SF MoMA, and also a small gallery show, and so forth, and all of these things are going on at one time.
But don't you think there's something very absent from this? And it's something actually you point to in your own article. Where is the critical discourse? Where is the edge here? This seamless transdisciplinary thing where all sorts of nice things are happening and being made and easily consumed, I imagine, and marketed. Where is that space of dissent and critical discourse?
Would it be between the people that he works with?
Just around the debate. You yourself raised this about the paucity of good critical debate about design art, and one could translate that to this model for a future transdisciplinary practice.
I think any artist that's in a position of some power today, and whether it's Oliver or it's Liam Gillick or Thomas Demand, they very carefully inbuild a critical discourse on the work and court that. So some of the leading historians, academics, and critics have written on all of these artists' works since very early on. So I think the idea of the critic or the critical discourse being separate or coming after the work doesn't happen with these guys.
But in this model you're describing, that it's not happening, presumably on the MFA.
No, I mean I think it is. I think but it's inbuilt into the structure. It's not something that's autonomous and comes after. It's inbuilt, and that there's a danger there as well, of course. But I think it's a very different model. And it's very controlling of every aspect, and nothing's left to chance, I don't think, such as critical discourse.
did you say just that your book would be following up on this?
And yeah.
That's interesting, because I mean, you know, it is a complicated subject, and look forward to seeing it. We're nearly out of time, and I'd just like to thank Patricia Bickers, editor of Art Monthly, and Alex Coles, who've both come in today. Alex especially came by train from outside London, so we're very grateful.
I did.
I also like to talk to you listeners and hope that you will consider subscribing to Art Monthly. We do a very special offer for residents listeners, a 30% discount on our magazine subscription. If you go to artmonthly.co.uk by email, you can email subs@artmonthly.co.uk or the website, which is www.artmonthly.co.uk. There's lots of information, and we hope you listen again next month. That's it, really. But so thanks again to Patricia and Alex for coming, and for you for listening. Goodbye.